Hello and welcome to Dominaria's Judgment, your mostly weekly, mostly modern constructed magic podcast. I am Ari Lax. I am mostly not sick this week, and I am mostly joined by Dom Harvey. But this week, we have illustrious friend of the podcast, Jarvis Yu, instead, to discuss a more holistic topic that maybe him and I have experienced a lot of back in our Pro Tour days in the mid-2010s, which is the art of generating good results and good data from small sample sizes.
Yeah, I'm really happy to be here. Obviously, this sort of stuff is my bread and butter for work as well. Maybe not so much the small sample sizes. We have some bigger data sets at work, but the general ideas are all applicable, I think.
Yeah, it is a good idea to have a literal mathematician on when you are talking about statistics, and Jarvis is literally a mathematician.
Yep.
But before we get into talking about the results of the week, nonsense of the week, and that main topic, we do have some basic housekeeping to take care of. So as always, you can find us on Twitter at Dominaria_pod. You can, well, you're listening to this podcast, so you have found it somewhere where podcasts are available, but it is available most places where podcasts are distributed, sold, whatever happens to them through the internet ether. You can find us on Patreon at Dominaria_judgment. And, well, I just want to say thank you to our new patron, Zachary, but also thank you to all of our patrons in general over the last calendar year. It's been, I guess, a bit under a full year since we've, you know, been back after our post-SCG break, and just really glad for everyone's support. It's been a really good time producing the podcast, and I'm glad we, you know, keep doing it, and I'm glad people keep enjoying it. So thanks again, and looking forward to 2023 in terms of what we can put out for the podcast and where, you know, the formats we like playing really start going. So with that out of the way, let's actually just talk about Magic Online deck lists, because they are mostly back, continue the trend of the episode. They sort of fell apart over Christmas, which was pretty nice coincidence with the break we took. I think literally right after the last episode we recorded, the tool stopped working, and also everyone left the Wizards and Daybreak offices for the season. And then they fixed them when they got back. And then as of this Sunday, there were just no deck lists again. But fortunately, the hamster showed back up on Monday and got back on the wheel, and the deck lists have continued to be churned out.
Well, so I think like it worked for a bunch of deck lists up until January 5th. Then it stopped working. And I found one prelim where it had the standings, but no deck lists. So somehow it just like half broke, but not fully broke. It was very bizarre.
I'm sure someone played an illegal card name and it has destroyed everything. So that's really, you know, someone over on the Daybreak side will have to look through the entire database of every Magic Online card ever and then be cast into the fire when they understand the forbidden knowledge of what the fix is, but only after they have fixed it. With that, sort of a quick catch up on those gap weeks. There was a really huge surge in Murktide over those weeks. When we had last left, it was kind of Murktide was competing against Rakdos for the top of the format, and then there were a couple decks underneath, and then there was just like a couple weeks where Murktide just decided to beat everybody and everything. And then we kind of saw the immediate reaction of Hammer Time with Brent and Forgetender. I believe this is Mario Gomez, I believe is the username, mm-hmm. And it's a player that we've seen win a challenge with Forgetender Hammer before, and just doing the same thing to beat up on Izzet. And then also Yawgmoth having a big resurgence, you know, pretty obvious of like the Murktide matchup for that deck is pretty reasonable and the Rakdos matchup is not good. So if people stop playing Rakdos and start playing Murktide, that's good for Yawgmoth.
Yeah, I think that's pretty interesting. I actually did choose to register Murktide myself in the showcase. I chose a slightly different build that had a Snapcaster and 20 lands. I didn't do very well, but I think the theory behind it makes sense. The list was originally from Twinless Twin, whose name pops up a lot in the modern results.
Okay, so I guess let's just quickly talk about that Snapcaster Mage, because that has been a card that has, I think there was a period where it was pretty popular in Murktide and then just kind of disappeared with Ledger Shredder. What does it offer today that it kind of has rotated back into favor?
I think just a lot of the games are grindier. Like, if you think about, you know, playing, you know, drag down fights versus people trying to grind you out. Like, in the games where Rakdos doesn't have its Voidwalker or Unlicensed Source or whatever, like, Snapcaster Mage is pretty good versus them in ways that, like, maybe not other grindy cards would be.
Yeah, okay. So it's basically just, like, your fifth Expressive Iteration most of the time, but also occasionally a Shriek Maw.
Yeah, pretty much.
That checks out. The other, I guess, kind of quick catch-up was Creativity. There was that Jund list that had popped up before we took a break. That kind of circled back to traditional teamer creativity. I don't think Leyline Binding, this was, I think, like, there's been a couple mana leak lists pop up, but it's, I want to say, about 70-30 in favor of the teamer list over the Jund list, but, like, the deck is still just doing okay and not really good. And then there was also, I believe, a PTQ won by Breach, but not Breach combo. And I know you tried that deck, so do you want to fill in some of the gaps on what's sort of going on there?
I think, well, so after that happened, I went back and looked at that person's, like, history of decks. They play a lot of interesting, like, riffs on decks that people don't really consider. Like, well, when Lurrus was legal in Modern at the very beginning, they played, like, Lurrus, Meddling Mage, Snapcaster Control. So I think they are just always out there, like, drumming their, you know, beating their own drum, trying something slightly different. I think what they probably identified was, how do I build a Breach deck that doesn't have to play cards like Grinding Station? Because I consider playing Grinding Station a bug of the deck. Like, you kind of don't want to play that card if possible. And also, like, the question is, well, how good is Urza Saga if you expect to be, like, you know, dressed down to, like, about 50% of your matchups from Murktide or something like that? So I think that's what's going on with that list. And also, like, the other thing is, it just, it can do an Izzet impression a lot of the time because it plays four DRC, you know, some number of Ledger Shredder, depending on who you talk to, and Ragavan, a bunch of removal and Expressive Iteration. So you kind of get a lot of what Izzet Murktide offers you. You just trade Counterspell for Underworld Breach, and, you know, a few other structural things are going on there.
Okay, so it's more of an Izzet than a, the Breach deck is what it sounds like. And you sort of have a short combo with multiple Dragon Rage Channelers.
Yep.
I think that's kind of a dream. I've actually been playing a lot of traditional Breach recently, and I kind of want to push back against the idea of, like, Grinding Station being a bug. I think that's like calling Splinter Twin a bug. Splinter Twin was just like, I don't know, it's in this case, your Splinter Twin is still your Splinter Twin, but your Pestermite is Breach, and that's just, like, a better card. So I don't know. It's, I'm still not, like, 100% sold on Breach. My opinion has slightly turned around from my older opinion of, like, it just being an Urza Saga deck that exploits when Urza Saga is good with something else to win the games where Urza Saga is not good. Like, I definitely struggled with the deck being, like, if you, I'm trying to think of the right analogy for that deck. That, like, I think the Izzet Breach deck is probably something I would be a lot happier playing against a deck like Scapeshift, where they are heavier on disruption, but also have a hard combo. And you just end up in this spot of being, like, mediocre aggressive deck against deck that is, like, expecting Ragavan and Urza Saga in general. And, like, the combo deck without counterspells versus the combo deck with counterspells and none of your interaction lines up. The teamer creativity deck offers some of the same issue, but I could see the Izzet list that you're talking about being, like, much better in those matchups where it's just like, I don't know, just going to, like, beat you down with normal Izzet cards if you decide to go down this hybrid combo route.
One thing is, when I tried that deck, Amiotitan was kind of a problem in game one because you didn't really race basically any of their draws, because I think the way that this Breach deck works is you're not really a turn three deck. You're probably, like, I feel like if you had a perfect hand, you are, like, a turn four deck. But more realistically, I think what I expect to happen is you kind of just play a grindy game and then Breach kills them. Like Yawgmoth's Will style, not, like, combo style, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it's, the analogy has been brought up to Treasure Cruise, but it's also like, okay, what if Treasure Cruise was the red version of Treasure Cruise?
Right.
Where you just can bolt your opponent a bunch of times. I guess, so that deck kind of violates one of the things I liked about Prowess, which was overlapping of Channeler and Breach's graveyard deck or graveyard threats. But like, that's not really, I was thinking about that, and like the normal Breach deck has Emery, so that like it has the same overlap, and it's not like you regularly win games against Leyline, so I don't think that's a huge deal.
And one thing I want to point out is actually Canister has been working on iterating a lot of these decks. He's just, I think when he gets bored, he likes working on new decks. So he actually was going to play the showcase with Jund Creativity. I want to bring that up. So that's the data point for that deck. But also he did work a lot on this like no grinding station Breach deck as well. And his conclusion was to cut the card Metamorphose, which I think that tells you about how he views the deck more than anything else. Like, I think he views it as less combo-y than other people, but you can combo kill someone, if necessary, later in the game.
I mean, does Metamorphose do anything that a Bauble doesn't besides, like, the immediate card return if you're digging for something? I'm kind of skeptical of that.
No, I think it's just extra Baubles is how I view the card. I mean, like, okay. The original version had Baral, but everyone quickly cut that card because it's not great.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess it is worse than Bauble, and you might not actually want the slightly worse, but maybe you do want Baubles 5 through 8. I did appreciate your comment about intending to play Jund Creativity, because it sounds like Canister just forgot to click the join button.
It was some UI problem that, like, I'm surprised it happened to him because he's usually good about that, but probably, like, he was trying to join with a certain deck, managed to not join whatsoever.
Got it. Or, like, draw. Yeah. I am interested in the 3 Sarah Emissary in the sideboard of that deck. So it's just like the Jund Creativity list we're talking about with Persist and everything. And this sideboard plan is 3 Sarah Emissary, presumably against, like, Hammer or something?
I would assume that if you get multiple emissaries versus Hammer, they can't win because you name instant with one creature with the other. I think if you can only creativity for one, you're just forcing him creature and hope you can redo the thing before your thing gets pathed, right?
Yeah, but I guess Amulet Titan, if you'd have to name creature land to beat Valakuts. Yeah. I don't know exactly what it comes up against because Archon is so good, but there's like, it is interesting to see a really big sideboard shift like that out of these creativity decks, because we haven't really seen people fiddle with that too much outside of like a Sunburning Titan or an Emrakul for whatever reason.
I saw it was Gold Ducat, aka Daniel Gottschall, played 2 Titan of Industry in Mana Traders. I'm not sure really what it was for or like what it's doing, but that is a data point. Like, I think he might have just taken some inspiration from Pioneer or like historic creativity where people do that. And like,
I could see the Titans being like, there are matchups where Naturalize is more powerful than Archon.
Right.
So that it might just be the biggest reclamation stage on the block.
Or maybe you're dodging Orvar. Like, I kind of think this Orvar stuff is nonsense and people should stop playing it with the adaptions to the creativity deck, but who knows?
Yeah, I have had mediocre experiences with Orvar. I know others have too. I think it is good out of like almost exactly goblins, but that's about it.
What about elementals with Flamekin Harbinger?
I mean, moving ahead to this weekend, Tommy Ashton did finish in 17th place with that deck. I think, I don't know, I just don't think about elementals because I played with the deck and I was just not a fan. It felt really clunky and, I don't know, just like not a good deck. My opponent just like played Haragavan on turn one and it's like, okay, well, I'm playing this Flamekin Harbinger and I don't really want to find any card because like I need lands and spell. Like, it's just, I don't know. It's just really tough. Like, your hands are full of garbage, and I think it is a better deck for a format where people are, I think it's kind of a victim of the success of the other Fury decks in some ways, where like you just can't show up with a deck that dies to Fury because good luck, you lose. And from that, you end up in this spot where like the traditional Elemental's edge was that it was just maxed out on free spells, and if you could break up your opponent's early turns, you just ended up in this, like, Shriekmaw chain in the late game with all these Risen Reefs. And, like, if people are just showing up with decks that can survive that and power through, it's just, I don't know. I don't really know what it's attempting to do right now.
Yeah, I don't really know either. Who can say? It's the problem, maybe sort of related very slightly to our main topic, is I'm not sure it's a great data point that Tommy's winning with a deck versus, like, someone who's significantly weaker player than Tommy, if that makes sense.
Yeah. I also want to point out that Voice of Resurgence in Modern is still heinous, even though I've come around to liking it in Pioneer after my dabblings with various Selesnya 80 card piles. We'll get to that in a minute. I guess we started talking about this week's events. There was a showcase challenge and a regular challenge. I think they're pretty about what you'd expect. I think the main thing is that we had this narrative of, like, Murktide showing up, Hammer and Yawgmoth coming back. Hammer and Yawgmoth had a okay weekend, mostly Yawgmoth, but Scam kind of showing back up in big ways is a big deal for that deck. It's just kind of like Murktide didn't run away with the format, so Scam gets to come back.
Yeah, interesting stuff. I know there are some people who question the idea that is Murktide actually favored versus Scam. I'm not really sure. I haven't played that matchup a lot. Like, honestly, I don't have a lot of incentives to play a ton of Modern right now. I played a little bit. So there's just so many questions to ask. And, you know, I think that's also related to the main topic. You know, how do you determine, like, if one deck is favored versus another? How do you spend time efficiently trying to determine that sort of stuff, you know?
Yeah, my limited experience has been that Scam is able to keep it close, but then anytime the Murktide player top decks Murktide or Expressive Iteration in, like, okay, the turn five range, it just falls apart.
I see.
We did see the first Living End return in a long time, which may be correlated to a drop off in Scam because that matchup is quite bad.
Oh, I would definitely believe that matchup is bad. Yeah. Voidwalker is just oof.
Though it does look like, did Living End lose to Team of Rhinos in the finals of this event? This is the Become Immense Rhinos deck that is like the old cards, just Rhinos.
Besides Become Immense. Is Become Immense an old card or is it a new card?
Well, Become Immense is the only, is it an old new card or a new old card?
It's a new old card is how I would probably put it. Actually, that makes some sense because I think if you play Rhinos versus Living End, don't you just want to cut down the number of turns you actually have to play against, like, multiple Cascade spells trying to clear your board?
Yeah, you want the chance to, like, also the, you can set up these attacks where, like, depending on the size of their Living End, like, if you go like first Rhinos, they Living End, and then you have second Rhinos and a Become Immense, you can actually go over the top. Like, they have a few things. Mm-hmm. That really brickwall you, like a Waker or a Striped Riverwinder. But if you are actually able to Become Immense over a Waker, I could see that causing problems.
Also, I would like to note that Become Immense plus Fury is 18 damage.
That's a lot of damage. I now want to pair those together with Touch the Spirit Roman, something like this. But just Rhino Scam. Maybe that's dreaming too big.
We'll leave that to Doomwake. He'll make it happen.
That's true. The only joy that he can pull from Modern is casting Violent Outburst and making 8 power, so I will leave that to him. I guess the only other notable thing from these top 8s is that Sodek can still play Dredge, which, good stuff. I'm glad that some things don't change despite New Year's.
I think Dredge is ahead versus Murktide in my limited experience in talking to Murktide players.
My experience has been it's dependent on how many spell pierces are being played.
Okay.
I think that very specifically, like, I don't think these dredge lists are very good at starting off the dredge chains in a relevant, like, fashion without getting one of their big draw spells on the stack. And, like, the games where they just get spell pierced are really problematic. Like, Sodek, like, what are you doing? You have Dark Blast, Otherworldly Gaze, and Tome Scour as ways to sort of slow dredge, but I don't know. I have always viewed, like, slow dredging as a route to failure, especially if you're, you know, the Murktai deck does not give you a ton of time to slow dredge.
Fair enough.
Yeah. And I think, you know, you would mention Pioneer. You are trying to prep for some Pioneer stuff going on for you. I guess let's start off with actually discussing Pioneer. Where do you feel yourself falling in terms of that format?
So, yeah, this is something I wanted to ask you about. In terms of win rate versus experience with decks versus how do you actually decide when you only have a week to test? I guess I'll also related to our main topic, because I think not just small sample size, what happens if you just have a limited amount of time to prepare for a tournament? What are you supposed to do? My question was, okay, you look at this data that Frank Carson has so kindly assembled that's aggregated from, you know, all of the RCs. I think he literally went through all the RCs he could find and put them into this one, you know, thing. And if you just look by the numbers, the best decks are Gruul Vehicles and Lotus Field, I think. Also, Fires and Rakdos Sacrifice. Some of those, I think you should account for how heavily they are represented versus their win rate. In my mind, the best deck that has a lot of representation and win rate is probably Mono White Humans, if that tracks.
Yeah, that looked like the result of that data. I do think that some of that is also, like, you have to account for the fact that those win rates are averaged over a shifting metagame. Like, I would bet that the second 50% of results are way worse for a deck like Lotus Field than the first 50%. Sure. I know that just from looking at the, like, initial data from, like, the U.S. and Canada, where it was just, like, Lotus Field wins 60%. And, like, the fact that it's been dragged back down to 53%, I think that's a pretty big statement. Like, this is way back in the day, like 20 years ago, almost at this point, where you would have like Mike Flores with his, you know, black boxes and then blue boxes for decks that won extended PTQs. And like, you would see these stats on a micro scale every week shifting.
Yep.
And there was always this reaction to whatever was winning. And I think that this data obfuscates that a lot.
Sure. So the idea to elaborate to the people who are listening is things evolve over time. Aggregating all of the tournaments, even if they're all like regional championships, literally speaking, isn't great because decks evolve, matchups evolve. The matchup might not be the same for two decks facing off, even though it would be the same two decks under the classification of decks, you know?
Yeah, and I think some of the decks are more vulnerable to that sort of polarization than others. Like, Gruul Vehicles may actually be a sleeper here, where, like, I don't recall it having great win rates at the start, and it just, like, has solid win rates throughout. And, like, Mono White has been consistently putting up good results, but, like, Lotus Field is the exact kind of deck where, like, if it is performing well, like, it's very easy to see that reaction. Same with Selesnya Angels. That deck, like, they're listed 9th and 10th most popular decks with decent win rates. And, like, yeah, those two decks feel like they're very easy to react to now that they're known quantities.
I guess to boil it all down, my question to you would be twofold. A, what would you pick? And B, what questions would you want to answer before you pick, I guess?
Oh gosh, that is a great question. I don't have an answer for what I would play in Pioneer. I've been kind of dabbling, and I think the format kind of lends itself to this, where I used to mostly hate everything I played. I feel every deck I play is enjoyable but flawed in pretty critical ways. I think that the big thing to realize is that, like, this is, you know, these win percentages are all in this, like, 53% range, which I think even over this, like, sample size of tournaments is, I always seem to recall Modern even having these kind of, more polarized results for certain decks over time periods than this. I think that Pioneer like naturally lends itself to decks just ending up in spots where they're like 58% in their good matchups, just because of the nature of removal and threats in the format, where it's just like, it's the classic, like, your opponent plays Fable on turn three on the play, and you're playing Azorius Control, and you die. But, like, if you were on the play, maybe you could counter it. And it's, like, a lot of these things where, like, the bad matchups are created by scenarios where half the time you're on the draw, and therefore you're 30%. But if you're on the play, you're, like, 60%, and that just percentage doesn't balance out to you being ahead. I think there's, like, a lot of play draw and, like, starting hand dynamics in Pioneer that are not as present in other formats these days, that are really sort of covering everything up, which is to say, I think that you can get away with most reasonable choices out of this list. I think that I don't actually know if I would bias towards like something stable, like Izzet or Rakdos. I kind of would just like push forward on Selesnya Angels almost as a reasonable choice. My experience with Gruul Vehicles was that despite it having this great win right here, it was actually one of my least favorite decks out of the metagame. I think that there are just a lot of... It is one of the decks that sort of defies that matchup spread, because if your opponent just doesn't care about Sky Sovereign and a Crone War, good luck, have fun.
Definitely agree with you. I also think there's just been a lot of response to Gruul Vehicles. Like, I saw Edgar post about Rakdos, and I looked at his sideboard, and first off, his plan was to just blank Skyboat by taking out all the creatures that were vulnerable to it, and sideboarding in like three Pithing Needles and like 9,000 removal spells.
Yeah, that sounds like a very traditional way for a mid-range deck to defeat a deck that is just a bunch of big things that could die to removal. I'm reminded of like, this used to be the plan with like the Cascade Jund decks, where you would just cut all the things you could cascade into that were bad, and then your deck just killed all of your opponent's creatures. Very smart. I would not. So Frank Carson had this list. We'll just say the 15 most popular decks in the format.
Sure.
Rakdos, whatever. Is it Phoenix? I like a little more than Rakdos, but not like a ton. Green Devotion is a fine deck. I think this is what you were referring to when you were talking about what decks you have the most experience with versus the win rate.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I don't really have a problem with any of the top four decks here, which are Rakdos, Monogreen, Izzet, and Humans. I like Azorius more than any of those other decks on an actually playing it level, but I would not play it because of its bad matchup against Rakdos midrange. Like, that matchup is just not good. And the other matchups are all like, I don't want to say you're hanging on by a thread, but like, they're all very close, and you're not gaining extreme edges against anyone besides the Angels players by playing Azorius. Just the cards are really good versus everything else, and it's like a very enjoyable play experience, but I would not choose that. Same with Vehicles. It feels like it just has a lot of gaps in what it's presenting. Obzon Greasefang, I just don't like. I think the deck is just inherently flawed in terms of its fail rate. Very flashy when it succeeds, very bad when it fails. Relatively, it can fight through the lockout pieces, but it's relatively easy for your opponent to present them. I would just like not touch any of the Fires of Invention decks. If you would like to, you know, Dom is not on the podcast this week, so he can proselytize about the Enigmatic Incarnation stuff, but I believe his exact words were, it is fun and better than you expect it would be, but I'm just not going to touch it. Lotus Field, I think, is a deck that you want to play against people who are more predictable than like an average RCQ, where like your opponents are going to play good decks with sideboards aimed at things and not decks with sideboard slots that they spend on Damping Sphere. I think the Spirit decks are a little better than they are advertised as, but I think I prefer the Angels deck to them.
Mm-hmm.
And that deck has really, really polarized matchups. But like, if you look at this spread of decks, I think it's pretty good against a lot of them. So I would not discount Angels. I think Angels is like I don't know if the good version of Gruul Vehicles is the right way to describe it. But like, all these polarizing decks that I don't like, it feels like the one that I do like. And then Rakdos Sack, I need to play some with again, but when I played it last time, I enjoyed it a lot, but it had some like flaws with specific matchups. Also, the Green Devotion matchup is sketchy, but so maybe it's actually a good time to show up with Rakdos Sack, which is reflected in the data and I think in the Magic Online data from recent weeks.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I think my answer going through all this holistically is like any of the best four decks, a couple decks sprinkled down like Angels, but like Rakdos Sack is probably the deck I would be spending limited time on to see if it's good.
Fascinating.
Yeah, I don't know where you sat before this discussion.
I mean, personally, from also I don't want to track down a million cards perspective, my options were, is it Green or Rakdos? And I know that's kind of like a cop-out excuse, but I think there is a lot to be said for your sanity for not having to scramble for an entire deck like the Friday before a tournament as well.
Yeah, especially when it's like a local RCQ and the options are all relatively close. I could see myself really wanting to play Rakdos Sack if the numbers, like if I played it and it was like, sure. Oh yeah, this is a snap deck I should play. Like, I would scramble for the cards for that, but that's the only thing that I think could be that far of a runaway for me to want to play it.
All right. And
track everything down on that level.
Well,
I deliberately ignored Mono Red because...
I also don't think that deck is particularly good, which is shown by the fact that people who were proselytizing for it no longer do so.
Yep. Yeah, so I guess... You plan on sitting down and playing some Pioneer over the next, let's see, we're recording this on Tuesday, so you probably have, well, I took up one of your nights, so you have three nights. Good luck. So that is definitely some small sample sizes on top of your previous knowledge. And I kind of want to reference back to the initial origin point of this whole small sample size discussion, which is a tweet from Andrew Ellenbogen, actually 3 years or 4 years ago today. Oh my gosh, that was a while.
Really? It's 4 years?
Exactly 4 years. January 10th, 2019, which is competitive magic is the art of correctly generalizing from sample sizes too small to draw real conclusions. And yeah, that's a true thing. It really is. I take offense to the idea that like there's no way to generate sample sizes big enough because it certainly is very possible to do so with you know, even just your own data, but like it's hard to generate data sets that are large enough to be like raw numbers, no extra cognitive analysis level relevant for everything that is going on just by yourself.
I think the term you're looking for is it's too hard to generate statistically significant results.
No, it's hard to, it's the green M&Ms problem. You can't test 20 things properly and end up with the right confidence intervals on everything. But you could test like 5 things properly and have good ideas about all that.
Well, actually, it's funny you bring up that one. I think that's the wrong analogy because that refers to the fact that you're not allowed to aggregate data sets and then unaggregate them. But that's a different issue. Basically, what do you do when you don't have a huge data set, or, you know, what if you just have to switch formats every week, which some of the NRG players, I think, have had this problem. And it's very similar to us switching, you know, from Grand Prix to Grand Prix, like a different format every week. What do? You don't have a lot of time. And how do you make good use of your time is, I guess, a good question as well.
Yeah, well, I think I want to start with... kind of the stupid answer, which is like, I think the way organized play is structured now, you can choose to engage with it in a way that ignores this problem where you just play a format or you just play, no, you are playing a specific event in a specific format in a broader amount of time than you used to have and kind of avoid the real crunch time and be like, I'm just going to do my thing with enough time. Mm-hmm. That is a choice. It has a cost of like maybe not playing other events that you want to play depending on where you live and whether those are offered. But I think it is a lot easier to do now than back in the days of like the full on GP and PPTQ into RPTQ and all this stuff grind. I don't think it's, I think it is a lot easier to do today than it was when Andrew made that tweet.
Well, yeah, a personal example I'll give is the Grand Prix I won. There were four weekends in a row. I played all of them. The first was Grand Prix in Indianapolis, home of the infamous Jarvis clone photo, where I played Dark Jeskai, went 1-3. Next week, I went 16-1-1 with Lands. The week after, I went 11-4 in Limited. And the week after, I went 6-3 with Amulet Bloom, I think. Yeah, that sounds right.
Was that Pittsburgh?
Or
was
it was Pittsburgh. I believe you played Niazu?
I played Burn with Wild and the Coddle.
Okay. Well, sort of close then. I was most of the way there.
Yeah, I mean, Lava Spike Zoo is another way to describe basically what it was, so yes.
But yeah, like, just trying to cram in all those different formats, and one of them was Limited, it's kind of challenging. I actually, for the Legacy GP, I brought two decks with me, which were Miracles and Lands, and Bob was just like, if you own Lands, I would play it in this event. Bob didn't own a Tabernacle, so he didn't play it. Bob Long.
That is a very classic Legacy problem.
True.
Yeah, the good thing for everyone in the Northeast is that every Tabernacle in existence has been sourced to somewhere between Maryland and New York, except for like the three that exist in Europe, is my understanding. Basically, no clue how that happened, but they all are in this small geographic region, which is kind of funny. But you know, I don't think the roundabout answer is what people are actually looking for. So I think that it is important to kind of describe what there is still a lower limit on what generalizing from small sample sizes, like generalizing from like half a game is possible, but like often just not correct, right? Like it's very rare cases. So like, what is a reasonable small sample size to you?
Great question. I tend to feel like I need to get some matches first to even have a baseline of what questions I want to ask. And I feel like that realm is like 10 to 15 matches. But of course, you can always play more and learn more things. I think one thing you really don't want to do is just assume that win rate is the thing you should be tracking, because I think that's the least important thing. I think like you should be taking notes about what happens in the game, or like what questions you want to have answered about the games when they pop up, you know?
Yeah, I mean, this is a pretty typical testing thing that people talk about, which is like, results matter less than figuring out what matters. Like, I mean, obviously, at the end of the day, it's who signs the match slip, but that is a long ways away from when you start grinding Magic Online leagues or whatever to figure out what you're playing. I know that Paul Riesel, a very good source, was known for saying that if he played less than 10 matches with the deck, he assumed he knew nothing about it. But he also is someone who was known for playing a million matches with literally everything. So it's hard to say whether like that is a personal volume sample size or not. I find it. So I guess this is like related back to a real principle in stats of like, you need a smaller sample size the more polarized your actual data point is. So like, if your deck is very good or very bad, you will likely figure it out a lot faster. The classic example I think I've cited recently-ish on the pod when we went over the PT-RTR retrospective was that it basically took me one match against Infect and two matches with the deck to determine that it was broken and really good. Similarly, I have 0-2 dropped or 0-3 dropped from leagues with decks that are clearly non-functional. So I think anything, you had a good point, which is like, if at the end of a few matches, you just don't know, there's a difference between, how would you describe the difference between not having additional questions and not knowing, like, how do you know when you don't have more questions to ask versus when you don't know what those questions are? Like, how would you describe those two different scenarios?
Oh, that's kind of a tricky one, and that's like a problem that you're going to just have all the time when you're working on decks. I think, in my experience, I know I don't have any questions when I just basically know all of my plans versus the major decks as a deck, and that is a lot of work to get to that point. or you have like a cheat sheet from like a friend. You know, we've done that a lot. We've borrowed like someone's list and just like, okay, how do I set up in this matchup? What should I be doing? That's a good way to cheat sometimes. And it saves a lot of work and thinking time. So if I don't have any questions about how to approach the major matchups, I think that's a good indicator that I don't have questions to ask. And then if I don't know how to approach matchups, but I don't know that yet, but clearly I... what's the best way of putting it? I think if I cannot elaborate what my major matchup plan for all of the major matchups is, even if I don't know the exact question I want to ask, I know that's where I still need to be working on things.
Yeah, and I think you can kind of boil that down to, like, if you still don't know how to answer the question. So I think both of the things were, like, you don't have any more questions because you have an opinion, or, like, you don't have any more questions because you don't know what to ask. I think you can kind of ask, like, what needs to happen for me to win this game and what is going to happen if I'm going to lose this game. If you don't have an idea, if you have an idea of one of those, that can mean like that's a like a really specific case where you start thinking about like, well, have I figured it all out? If you don't have an idea of any of it, like I don't know why I'm losing or winning, that is a sign that you need to like some you got to keep going and figuring it out, or like decide that there's just no way to spend the time on it. That's just kind of like one of those spots where it's like, yeah, it's not determined. I think that that brings us to like the next big point I wanted to talk about, which is like you end up in these small sample sizes, and that case where like I am winning and I don't know how I would lose, or I am losing and I don't know how I would win. I think those can be interesting cases and probably the spots where people make the most errors, which sort of brings to like to the two follow-up questions of like, if you are winning and you don't know how you would lose, I think the thing that you need to stop and look at is like, when you are playing your opponents, are they doing things that you would consider to be like impressive and correct for the format? Like, not just are your opponents making mistakes, but like, are you beating draws that are just like not the things that are driving the format? I think this is a pretty common issue in Modern where you beat people's draws that aren't just like, I don't know, play like an Unholy Heat and a turn 4 Creativity, and you're like, okay, maybe that matchup's okay. And it's just like, but what if they just draw like Ren and Six and Creativity? And you're just like, oh yeah, my entire deck falls apart.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. That's why I think the note-taking aspect matters a lot, because if you note that, oh, my opponent didn't even play like their optimal hand or even close to it, and I'm winning that game, well, you're definitely going to have a different experience when they like go like Ragavan, counterspell your first thing, heat your next thing, and then like everything, and then they like cast an iteration, all of your stuff's dead, and they have like 6 cards in hand, you know?
Yeah, I think some of this is also relatable to Pioneer in the sense of like, what is, there's some amount of like, what is a good draw and what is a like reliably good draw here that you kind of have to have a broader understanding of the format for, where like you're technically your sample size on this deck is small, but your sample size with the format might be larger.
Yeah, definitely a good point. I mean, like, there are definitely decks in Pioneer that can do stupid things, but they don't do them very often. Like, a good example, I think, is the Neoform Velomagnus Lorehold Time Warp deck, essentially, or the equivalent of it. That's, like, part the Water Veil, and I forget what the other one is, but people tried that at the beginning, then it fell off quickly because it was pretty clear that it wasn't... It didn't really do that thing very often, you know?
Yeah, you can't really flip things reliably. Like, it's a collect company issue just repeated, or I like to call it the dredge issue, where like, if you know, you always miss some important piece when you're flipping the cards or people like that. It didn't line up. I think that Obzon Greaswing is a really good example of this, where like the draws where you're just like, well, I'm going to die to a turn 3 Greaswing. It's like, well, your opponent just doesn't do that enough of the time because they need to have like the Parkelion and this number of cards, but also like a way to put it there. And like, I don't know, I've had the experience where like they whiff enough that I just kind of assume that the games where they are turn 3-ing me are not quite an outlier, but also not the average case.
Yeah, Stitcher Supplier doesn't see that many cards.
No, just don't block it and you're fine. I do want to like bring up a story about the reverse where like if you are losing and you don't know how you would win, this comes down to like, why are you losing? Is there something specific that they are beating you with? And then just like, what happens if you pretend that thing isn't part of the game? This dates back to like, at least for me, like a really, when I was picking up Storm for the first time, I was losing to a lot of the like, not tempo blue decks, but the true control decks, because I just like, they would have more counter spells. And then like Brian DeMars, who had played a million more matches with Storm decks in old formats, was just like, you're just, what if you just like didn't play things into their counter spells and play the game of like, you know, my opponent has 12 counter spells in their deck, I'll just like eventually die. Like, what if you just didn't take game actions and then eventually tried to beat the seven cards in their hand and, you know, can they all be counter spells? Probably not. And that was like a really key tactical point in those matchups was like, you were supposed to win the games by like having eight cards in your hand and your opponent having seven cards in theirs and just playing your cards and eventually winning the game. Cause like they would run out of things to react with. And I think that there's a lot of, this is the Graveyard Trespasser issue that I cite a lot where I think that, it is easy to lose games if you take game actions that are like, Graveyard Trespasser is going to beat me immediately, so I have to kill it, and therefore I lose resources, and everything falls apart. Whereas, like, I don't know, you just kind of ignore the card for a couple turns, and then eventually kill it, and it's usually fine.
Yeah, definitely agree with you there. Yeah, I think that lesson actually comes up a lot. There's also just sometimes, like, you can just pretend they don't have it and see what happens if you lose. Like, I think probably people don't shove as often as they should with combo decks in certain formats nowadays, but I guess that's like kind of a different issue than from your example. I think you don't actually ignore that the card exists. You just plan to work through it later, I think is what I'm trying to say. Right.
Yeah, it is not something you should warp your plan around, because I think this is generally a spot that is very easy to lose in, is the spot of like, especially with today's cards, playing a react to spell versus just like doing your thing. And just like, I think that people are like, you also cited the like, not, you know, just you gotta jam and see what happens sometimes. I think this is like a, I don't personally have a good heuristic that is like tangible and like, I don't know. It's just the good vibes of like, yeah, I feel ahead, therefore I don't have to do anything. Or like, I'm afraid of something happening, therefore I have to shove. I wish I had come prepared with a better way to talk through the difference between those two scenarios. But it really is just intuition for me at this point. I don't know. Do you have any ways to kind of, you know, spin that out through the discussion of like, is it, when is one versus the other?
So I think the easiest example to use is Legacy here, because I think the scenarios are kind of harder for me to elaborate. So basically, I look at my hand. Suppose I'm playing like Sneak and Show, right? I have a Show and Tell, a Brainstorm, and a Force versus like some random deck. And like say a Gristlebrand. If I think my opponent has like a Daze, I'm not going to just shove immediately when I have the Brainstorm in hand. But if my hand's just like Show and Tell, Gristlebrand, and, you know, Ancient Tomb, Lotus Petal, I think I'm going to just shove blind or whatever and just hope it works out, because I don't have a path to work through them having anything anyways. So I think that's the kind of example I'm envisioning. If you have a way to like get to another plan that makes sense in a timely enough fashion where you're not losing anyways, you should probably pursue that. And if you don't, just jam. I mean, you can always draw more Show and Tells as well, you know?
Yeah, I think that like the other, you can kind of boil down the non-combo, like the non-proactive case of like, I know when I am playing with, so Azorius Control in Pioneer is actually a really good example of this, because I love playing with these stupid control decks that have like derpy counterspells and like some big doofus threat like Starnheim Unleashed or Torrential Gear Hulk or Wandering Emperor, and just like having these games where like you're the control, but then like then you're the beatdown, and then your opponent's completely colded. And the way I approach those games, whether I'm like more reactive about their threats and things like that, often has to do with how deep, like, there is, and like how many layers of insurance do you have for a bad thing happening? Mm-hmm. And like, there's this thought of like, if the first bad thing happening to you is a catastrophe, and you just like, it's not, this is the show and tell situation we're talking about, where it's just like, mm-hmm. if they have it, there is nothing I can do and there's no rebuild. Like, I don't know, like waiting, that is a spot where like waiting is, so there's a two, like, what am I trying to describe here? Where like, they have a, like, it's just literally the blue-white deck makes it so easy because it's just like raw counts of counter spells. And like, the less you have, the more aggressive you have to be. And you just start playing for that end game where you flip the script faster if you don't have more counter spells. Whereas if you just have like two counter spells, you just kind of don't take game actions because the catastrophe that could happen is bad. But like, I don't know, you just have a game point where you will have counter spell and your threat at the same time, and it's fine. So mm-hmm. I think that there's like analogous situations with a lot of the show and tell stuff where like you get to continue to like, you're insulated against other bad things happening to you because you have other productive things to be doing before you pull the trigger on the high risk play. I think that's the right way to put it. I don't know. Did that make sense to you, or do you have a better way to put it?
No, I think that makes sense. I actually learned this lesson with, I think it was Psychotog, where like, I basically didn't play my Tog out unless I literally had no better option, but then like if I just didn't have like a factor fiction or a counter spell, I would just jam the Tog, hope it lived. And then if it lived, usually this is probably funny for some like younger listeners to listen about. Tog used to be like an unbeatable card in a long time ago. So like it would just cold entire boards by itself essentially. So that exact thing doesn't happen anymore, but it's sort of like the Murktide counterspell thing in, Modern, where like, okay, if I wait for counterspell plus Murktide, that's way better than just jamming Murktide. But if I don't have anything, I can just jam Murktide and see if they're dead.
You heard it here first. Murktide Regent is the Psychotog of 2023.
I've actually tried to make this analogy a lot and no one believes me.
Is it because they either don't know what Psychotog is or have decided to retire and like go fishing with the rest of their life?
No comment on that. Okay.
Okay. So I guess bringing this back to sample sizes, like this is a lot of good ways to extrapolate data from like not having to be in the same situation over and over again, because I think that in this spot, you can kind of, one of the keys is it's this overlap of like understanding what your opponent is going to do just by like looking at the cards in their deck list and which ones are going to beat you, but also being able to round a lot of it to approximately the same thing of like bad versus good, and not like knowing a ton of the details about which individual cards cause their own individual problems. And there are decks that will really force you to know that. Those are not small sample size decks. I'll just mm-hmm. say that right now, where like how each of your answers lines up against very specific things. This reminds me a lot about like playing Murktide this like last summer, where like you had to be super precise with how you lined up all of your spells against four color, like that you just can't. There are things mm-hmm. that are just non-small sample sizable.
Yep, definitely agree with you. Also, like building a deck with a bunch of tutors, like it's going to be hard to small sample size that stuff as well. I think
that's easier than you think it is, but that may also be like 2023 design heuristics of like, I don't know, mostly you just tutor for the good card and then like yeah, it's like Yawgmoth, right? Like Yawgmoth has a million tutors, sure. But like you just usually get Yawgmoth. So I guess on this discussion of like how to extrapolate things that aren't data from, or not like direct data, like you are doing analysis that isn't just like playing a bunch of games, there is an argument for like the small sample size stuff being slightly better because there is diminishing returns on generating data. Yeah, no, I was gonna say this is like literally, like if you look at the math of statistics, like the amount that you reduce the like estimated, you know, the uncertainty of a measurement is inversely proportional to like your sample size. Like the difference between 1 and 10 samples versus like is the same as I think the difference between 10 and 100 because it's root. I'd have to double check.
It is one. It's proportional to 1/(n), generally speaking. Yeah.
Yeah. So I mean, it's obviously not like exactly how magic math works, but I think there is a point where one of the things you need to do with small sample size is when you start saying, I would like to generate a larger sample size with this deck, keep asking the question of like, am I actually generating data that matters or should I just like do something else? Because there is a point where doing something else or doing something specific becomes the most important thing you can do. Knowing that point, obviously a little tricky. Any heuristics on knowing like, this comes back to the like, can I name what I need to do in these broad spots? And is there a spot where I don't know what I need to do?
Yeah, I think that's a difficult question. I usually just wing it for, I mean, that's probably not the answer the people are looking for. But I do want to say that one thing that I think I've encountered in like specific PT testing at certain points is be very wary of playing the same matchup over and over with exactly one person, because that can lead to a lot of like weird side effects. Just because not everyone's going to play the same way as that person. There's actually some value to diversifying who you play with.
Yeah, and I think this points towards one of the other issues with small sample sizes, which is like you don't always see what all the potential things that could be happening to you in a matchup are, because you either don't play against, you know, your opponent is not doing that because they don't approach the matchup that way, going back to the like, are they playing right? Or they just don't have the card in their deck. I think this was like a big failure point for a lot of Pro Tours, for a lot of people, where like, it's the classic, the example I like to cite is the Cascade Jund Pro Tour, where there were a lot of people who showed up who liked their Jund matchup, and then the Jund players who won just added 2 lands and therefore got mana screwed 5% less and just immediately reclaimed 5% against everybody. And they were just like, oh, this matchup is actually bad and I should not have done anything besides play Jund. I think that that kind of thing happens a lot. This is like, I don't know if it's as easy to say there's value to playing from the other side in these scenarios where you're not just like sitting down at a Pro Tour testing house and can pass the deck across the table. But is there like a modern day equivalent to like, I don't know, just using a small amount of time, like on trying to figure out if you are actually playing against, like if there is something your opponent could be doing differently that you need to prepare for?
So I think this was brought up by, let's see, I'm trying to remember. I think Ash on Twitter, ShudderMTG, brought up a very good point, which is, I think the way that a lot of people do testing is kind of has these issues, but something that I think I've never seen anyone do and have two people play a match and have an observer, and the observer doesn't say anything until all of the matches are finished playing with, then just talk about everything that happened in the matches played, I think might be a solution to that.
That is kind of interesting. I think that is sort of hard to do from the perspective of like if you are testing online, but that is a good thing to do in person where you're just like you're using the third person's time to kind of just figure out if there are things that one side could do that actually disrupt what either side individually sees and what they could figure out.
Yeah, because I think one of the issues with the online experience with people being like, you do often get three people in a call, like two people playing, but the third person kind of just like chimes in when they feel like. And I think that's actually more disruptive than helpful a lot of the time, is what I would say. It sounds like
you're describing Twitch chat.
No, like, I mean, of course Twitch chat's like that. I'm not going to deny that. But I'm saying that I think often, even in the Discord calls, that happens a lot in my experience, as just as an observer or being in those calls for like the RC prep that I've done. And I think it is not conducive to generating good results, is what I would say. Because also, maybe someone has something in mind, but when the third person chimes in, then the data sort of gets dirtied because both players, it's now in both players' mind what the third person said as well, you know?
Yeah, the watch and shut up part of this, the shut up part is the most important. I think this sort of almost loops back to our first discussion of like, sometimes you just got to sit down and play a bunch of games to figure out what the questions you were asking without asking, like, or like trying to make improvements and asking. I think that is probably, if we're talking about this in small sample sizes, is like understanding that you are taking small sample sizes, but you are not supposed to, you have to reach, this is sort of the endpoint discussion we had too, which is like, you have to reach a point where you know what the thing you are attempting to do is actually doing before you make a change, even if you're only playing a small number of games or matches with each deck.
Yeah, definitely. I think you have to reach a minimum baseline to know what the questions are that you need to have answered personally. I think there are some people who just intuit stuff very fast and they don't need as many matches.
I don't think it's specific people. I think this relates to one, that an aggregate of small sample sizes is a large sample size about the format and makes it easier to make these decisions. But some of this is also related to like, Magic is a rotating game where different styles of play are supported by the current card set, and who is intuitively right is often consistent for stretches of time, but not like long epochs of time, unless your name is John Finkel.
Yeah, that's definitely true. I mean, like, how different is standard Grixis midrange nowadays from like Jund midrange however many years ago, right?
Very. I think this, I mean, I don't want to talk about recent design versus old design, but I think that the current era of design is very different from most or many other past eras, just in terms of like, we're talking this, I want to highlight that topic of like, if you are losing to a card, consider if you can just play your deck through it instead of like worrying about it immediately, or the reverse, where like, the current era of Magic and the way they have balanced threats as like things that are like I think you had shared that article about someone talking about how Magic has changed to not be a game of like who is plus one or minus one a resource as much. I think that adapting to that has been just phenomenal. Like, it's, I want to emphasize that point about like deciding to play through or like against a card as much as possible. Like, that is a lot of how current Magic exists and how it needs to be played, because there's a lot less cases where answering a card at like is truly doable at parity, and like that decision is very tough.
So what you're saying is don't get Invoke Despaired, I suppose.
Yes. I mean, like, if you want to look back at past eras, there's like some amount of the like Hazoret era of like, you need to save your specific spell for a specific threat because it's unbeatable by everything else. And therefore you have to like line up every other card so that you can, you know, not die when your opponent casts something specific, which if you talk about a lot of the past Jund matchups or whatever, I don't think that's ever really been true. Like, even in the Thragtusk era, there was just like a lot of like goober exchanges and things like that that didn't really play to that sort of like precise answer level of like, you have to answer things but like line them up specifically, where like everything you play is sort of a control deck, but at the same time, like, the, I don't know, it's you are always, it's very weird to describe these two different paradigms where like, yes, you should play through stuff as if you're the aggro deck, but also like, don't die to very specific things like you're the control deck. It's a very weird spread. And I think that that is a very different thing than like any of the past eras I think we've mentioned.
Yeah, that's fair. I mean, I think the key difference is you can't really get away with letting threats basically happen to you very often now without like having an answer right away, because they'll just kind of kill you by themselves.
Yeah, the old fable of the mirror breaker problem. Yeah, I think that, yeah, it, if you, I think that I'm trying to think of the right way to say this, because it's been said before, where like another problem with small sample sizes is often just like we're saying, oh, play through something or like try to answer it at a specific point. It's like, I don't know, like how do you, like there's too many points and too many things.
Mm.
I think that I don't want to say crossing off answers, but like thinking about the most extreme versions of each and then trying to use that as a starting point, like making the decision a bit more binary than it would be, is pretty useful. Because often putting yourself in one of those very binary extreme situations will either work and show you why it worked or show you what caused it to not work. And then you can think about, well, could I have, you know, played 80% aggressive and then 20% around the specific thing that really tripped me up? Or like, you know, the other way around, where I like was 20% aggressive and gave myself an out to like push if X, Y, and Z happened. And I think it is easier to adjust from 100% down towards the middle than it is to sort of waffle in that like 60-40 range and try to feel it out from there.
Yeah, definitely agree.
Yeah, I think that this also is like small sample size, like the same principle as like play 10 matches with the deck or whatever, like, you know, mm-hmm. have your sample size matter. It's like choose a plan and try to figure out if you can figure out why that specific thing works or doesn't work. Because that's how you get to a why. You don't just kind of like bouncing around is kind of weird.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I don't know. Is there anything else on this topic of small sample sizes that you would like to cover? Because it kind of dives into a lot of the other fundamentals of Magic, because it is the culmination of it all, is like being able to do more with less time is the result of understanding the game.
I think we have most of what I want to say about it. I mean, the major point I have is I kind of think Magic in general for everyone is just a large sample, and you kind of just want to do this like every time if possible, obviously, but you know, kind of difficult to do that. Oh, and I personally believe that experience is sort of logarithmic with the deck. And what I mean is you do get diminishing returns every time you play a match, like kind of proportional to 1/N, I would say. But like if you play enough matches, you'll still accumulate like meaningful amounts. So obviously there's always value. But I think that's probably why, like, you know, I remember Pat Cox said he said he felt like he would learn the most in the first 15 matches playing a deck. And then after that, like, he kind of felt like he learned a lot less. That just represents the logarithm, like, kind of kicking in. Because, like, after 15, you just get less per match, you know?
Yeah, that sounds like some math nonsense to me. But I agree. And I think that's probably a good bridge into discussion of Nonsense of the Week and some decks that I don't know if you have had any small sample size experiences with these, but with a few weeks of Nonsense, we've had some good stuff going on. I do want to start with a Modern deck by the Honorable Selfie Sec, the original trophy leader back in the day of Mardu Pyromancer in, was that 2017, 2018?
Mm-hmm.
Selfie Sec would just have a million trophies with just Mardu Pyromancer every day, all day.
Mm-hmm.
And they are back, not quite Mardu mid-ranging it, but I do want to bring an update here on their latest exploits, which is a different version of Rakdos Scam in a different sense, which is Rakdos Pseudo Reanimator with Phyrexian Fleshgorger. This is the prototype card from the Brothers War, the, you know, 3/3 or 7/5 menace lifelink ward, as an alternate card to persist alongside Archon of Cruelty. And this is backed up by, as you would expect, sort of a Pyromancer shell of like Seasoned Pyromancer, Dragon Rage Channeler, and, you know, some removal and Bitter Reunion as well. Also an Underworld Breach and Blood Moon deck. Some interesting pairings going on there.
I'm looking at this deck and I'm very confused how you even get here starting from any other Modern deck. I guess the answer is you don't start from any other Modern deck, really, right?
I mean, I would assume the answer is you lose to Archon of Cruelty plus Persist when playing your Seasoned Pyromancer deck and decide that is where you want to go with it. And then from there, try to figure out how you can make it reliable. And that's where the Fleshgorgers come in. I do appreciate the one of Village Rites to go with the Stitcher Supply, mm-hmm. just like a really adorable. Oh, wow. I just realized that Underworld Breach is like additional persist with your Stitcher supplier.
Yeah.
That is really, really huge and adorable. Also adorable is the presence of a Shadow of Doubt and a Reality Hemorrhage in the sideboard. Do you know what Reality Hemorrhage is?
Yeah, it's bad pirate spell bomb.
That is a great way to describe it. It's the
so I've actually had this discussion with multiple people over the years about playing Reality Hemorrhage, and almost every time I ask them why they aren't playing pirate spell bomb, they never have an answer for me.
I think the answer here is that there's a Goblin Dark Dwellers in your deck.
Okay, I guess this is the one time I'll accept that answer.
Yeah, because like it does the same thing with Breach as a Pirate Spellbomb would, right? And it's actually worse because you could split up the cost potentially, but I think that the Dark Dwellers is enough of a push in the right direction. Though, with these Unholy Heats, I think I might rather have the other artifact for Delirium.
Wow, I won again.
Yep. Unbeatable. I hope you appreciate the title I gave this deck of Big Bug. Maybe you can provide that image for the show notes. But
oh god, let me find it.
Yeah. So there's a classic Magic Online photo where the text Big Bug shows up in the chat. And this week we have a challenge top 8 from New Year's Day with Big Bug. This is appropriately B-U-G under old terminology, so Sultai, insects. And my understanding from having skimmed through some videos of people playing this deck is that it is largely a, like, bad prison deck, but also, like, activates Grist sometimes. Do you have opinions on that, Jarvis?
You know, this deck is beautiful, and I have nothing I would change about it.
Yep. Highlights include Haywire Mite and Hex Parasite as 4-ofs that are insects that are also Urza Saga targets. Blex, Vexing Parasite. This is the Strixhaven MDFC where the front side is 2 green, 3/2 Lord for all your insects and several other creature types, but also gains you 4 life when it dies. And the back side is some arbitrary card draw card. Do you think it's realistic for this deck to crawl Harpooner a Murktide Regent?
Probably not, right? 23 creatures, no self mill. I mean, I guess Grist is a self mill. It seems really, really difficult to me still.
Yeah, I agree. And then I just like how Urza Saga is joined by Swarmyard, which is why you have all these colorless one drops, because you can't really pay colored mana on turn one with seven colorless spells, also cavern or 7 colorless lands plus cavern. So like, you know, you're basically mono, like colorless Sultai, just kind of some good stuff. I guess the Sultai is only Orvar in the wonderful MTG Goldfish color scheme. But
yeah, you can cast it off Cavern of Souls at least. Someone did ask me in a different Discord, why is there 3 Aether Vial and 1 Springleaf Drum? They were actually questioning the one drum. Then I pointed out that Saga kills itself like a large portion of the time, and getting the drum for the immediate mana payback happens a lot. But I do think it's interesting that there's still a 3 Aether Vial.
I don't think it's that interesting because this deck has Blex, Grist, and Realmwalker at 3 and really needs ways to churn those out while also being a Saga deck. Like, there's a lot of spots where your mana is getting locked up.
I have a question for you. Can you tell me what Blex does without clicking on it?
I mean, I did click on it earlier. The backside, though, is a delightful one. It's like 2 black for an instant, and you look at 5 cards from the top of your deck, and you can pay 2 life for each one you want to keep. It's just like the world's worst Sylvan Library activation.
Well, did you know that I've seen Legacy players play this card in Spanish Inquisition with Summoner's Pact and Coin the Week?
Oh, so you can Summoner's Pact the backside and draw cards, and it's like Infernal Tutor, or Infernal, what is the name of that card?
It's Infernal Contract or Cruel Bargain.
Yeah, this is the black, pay half your life, draw 4 cards card.
Yeah.
They don't make them like they used to.
Well, I mean, I guess you could theoretically cast Plex in that deck too, but I don't see why you would.
Listen, that deck had Odious Trow for a long time, so...
Oh, you know. It did.
Yes.
It sure did.
Yeah, the Springleaf Drum thing I think is a good thing to pick up on, because I have had the experience playing Breach that is one of the cards I find the most, just because mana is good, and not having mana is bad.
Yep, definitely true.
Yeah. Okay, so moving on from Big Bug, we have a Pauper combo deck bridging into Modern in the hands of Saffron Olive, obviously, if you see this kind of stuff. And that is the Putrid Goblin and then something that returns it with plus and plus one counters plus a Sacrifice
Olive. Okay, so this is Malera combo in the Zombie Shell.
Yes, so this is the card that enabled this is from the Brothers War. It's Thran Vigil, which is one in a black, which is whenever an artifact or creature leaves your graveyard, you can put a plus or minus one counter on target creature. So Putrid Goblin persists, it leaves your graveyard, put a counter on it from that. Loop the loop, Carrion Feeder gets very large, and the rest of the deck is just zombies. Also notably a Diabolic Intent deck, a card that has underperformed basically everywhere else.
Yeah, I think I actually saw a version of this in a Goblin Shell with Thran Vigil as well, but it also had Sling Gang Lieutenant and, you know, the usual suspects of Snoop combo as well.
That's interesting, that Thran Vigil there versus First Day of Class. I guess you can spread the mana spend out better if that's the case, but I would assume that if you actually put red mana in your deck, that First Day of Class would be a decent card to actually play. Like, if you First Day of Class like a Maul War Marshal, that's actually... I mean, it's not good, but it's reasonable.
Well, my question is that better than, what's the card, Metallic Mimic?
Probably, because that card just dies.
Okay, fair. I mean, it fails a Ren and Six test, which is kind of a disaster. I guess most of these decks kind of fail the Ren and Six test, so I'm not sure that's what you should be worrying about.
Yeah, there are a lot of cards that die to Ren and Six in this deck. Notably, the 3-mana 3-1 Headless Rider. That card is not good versus Ren and Six.
Well, at least you get a 2-2 zombie back.
Woohoo!
Look, I have a soft spot for that card because it reminds me of Rotlung Reanimator.
Yes, I have a soft spot for that card because the description of the alchemy deck that combos off with that card is just a delight, and it takes you a while to read it and then do the math about it. I believe it is what, like, Ashnod's Altar, and then there's a card that keeps conjuring itself back, and then it drafts another. I don't know. If someone wants to look this up, you can. I don't really want to take the time to go through the 8 million steps and the math chain of, like, the probabilities of drafting cards with the right mana costs from this card's spellbook, because that's just absolute nonsense. But once I figured it out, it did give me like the warm fuzzies of like a real 1997 combo deck.
Wait, what card is this?
There's an alchemy card that's a 2-mana colorless creature. When it dies, you draft a card from its spellbook, and then I think when that card dies, you get the 2-drop back. And you can permanently cast the card you drafted with colorless mana. And basically the joke is with Ashnod's Altar, you can sack the 2-drop to net 0 mana, draw a creature. There's the odds of you hitting something that you can sack for net mana are higher than the odds of you... You know, this is actually ending on a great math note. It's a unbound, like it's a statistically unbounded like outcome, right? Where the odds of you generating mana are... higher than the odds of you not generating mana because there's enough one drops and choosing one of three. And the end game is that eventually you get to cast Headless Riders and then the zombies off of them are like, that's a net mana, right? You Headless Rider and net a mana off the zombie. And eventually you have so much mana that you get to play the Headless Rider, keep it around through another iteration, and now all your loops generate a zombie that you drafted with it or whatever. And then another card, and then like you just end up with infinite zombies and mana and stuff.
Wow, I should try that deck.
Yeah, I don't know if it's still legal. They may have changed like, but it like absolutely dominated everything that it was legal in for a while. But I think that is an appropriate note to end it on. Jarvis, anything else you want to close out with Nonsense of the Week? Anything that you have been trying that is absolutely nonsense? And I guess where can people find you?
Well, let's think about nonsense. I did have a failed Storm deck I drafted in Cube where I killed someone with like manual Wheel of Fortune, Breach, Brain Freeze, but I was missing I didn't have the Lotus Petal or LED, so it was kind of difficult. So that's kind of nonsense. But
the Storm decks without the pieces to be Storm are always nonsense.
Well, I trophied, but that's because I was Jeskai midrange that happened to have Breach, Wheel of Fortune, Brain Freeze. I had like Fractured Identity and nonsense too. But where can people find me? Twitch.tv/RFSU. Twitter's good. I guess Ari can post a link in the notes. JKYU06.
What's your Twitter?
JKYU06 on Twitter. And yeah, I basically Twitch and Twitter are the best places to find. Best places yep. to find me.
You will find Jarvis streaming there. You can find me at ARMLX on Twitter or writing for Channel Fireball on a fairly regular basis. You can find Dom with us probably next week or at Twitter at Dom and Harvia or writing for Star City Games on a semi-regular basis. And again, you can find us, the pod, on Twitter at Dominaria_pod. You can find us on Patreon at Dominaria_judgment. You can find this podcast back to weekly, basically, again, wherever you found this last time or anywhere else podcasts typically are. And you can find us, like I said, next week here talking about various developments in constructed Magic formats. Thanks and have a great night.